you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour, and thank you for tuning in to the Twilight Histories. This is a show inspired by role-playing games, where you are the hero. You will travel to different worlds in the multiverse. Some are familiar, others are totally exotic. Today, you're going on a journey with our master storyteller, Kevin Valbonesi. Rings in the Mist was first launched a year ago to our patrons, and they went nuts. They loved this five-part series so much. Every time we uploaded a new episode, they filled the comments with things like epic, amazing, son of a quasar, and please tell me there's more. I've been hearing a lot of comparisons with this to one of our larger shows, Blue Dragons, and a few patrons have even told me Rings in the Mist is one of their top one or two all-time favorite Twilight History shows. So, today, you are going to be hearing part one of Rings in the Mist. And I have a feeling this one is going to go down as a classic Twilight History series. Just to let you know, we have started mailing out rewards to our patrons who support the show. We just shipped our first batch of 35 stickers, hoodies, shirts, and mugs, and there's more to come. There is no end. Anyone can get swag in the mail. All you need to do is join us on Patreon. And stick around for 3 months and you will get a package from the Twilight Histories. We're doing this in appreciation to all of our supporters over the past 10 years. We really are thankful. And this show, Rings in the Mist, absolutely would not have happened without you. All right, let's listen to Rings in the Mist, Part 1, by Kevin Valbonesi.
Thank you for coming. I apologize for waking you in the middle of the night, but matters have forced our hand. We're having difficulties with an off-the-books excursion. Probably goes without saying that this particular matter will require the utmost discretion. Now then, we detected an anomaly while preparing an adventure to medieval Ireland. As I'm sure you're aware, the paths we open to other times and places require a significant amount of energy, and that energy produces a rather singular signature. Well, we spotted a very similar signature quite far back in one particular timeline. We checked our readings over and over, and when it became apparent that there wasn't an error, we naturally alerted the higher-ups. The means by which we work our miracles here at the Twilight Histories are a most valued secret, and if there's any possibility that someone has stolen away with those secrets, then we must investigate. Or, if someone else out there in the expanse has found a way to do what we do, then we'd like to know a little bit more about the competition. You can understand that. Regardless, we sent a crew down to investigate, and while the initial reports were tantalizing, to say the least, matters have since become complicated. If you'll head over to the staging area, you'll find your gear and some supplies. Please get ready and I'll finish with your orientation. You're going back to ancient Ireland. We believe the era to be around 3000 BCE, but it's hard to get an exact read on it thanks to other anomalies present in the time stream. We expected to find some hunter-gatherers or a few pastoralists, but instead, our team discovered massive cities of a highly advanced nature. Every one to a number was arranged in a series of concentric circles, girded by immense walls with the remains of what appeared to be artillery. Some of the older cities were composed mostly of stone, but as the team ventured further into the Irish interior, they found metalwork far surpassing the means of any ancient people. And the technology. Well, the cities are vast, and as far as they could tell, they were abandoned. Following the signature we detected, the team finally arrived at one city, occupying the hill and surrounding countryside of what is now the city of Athlone, if I'm correct about that. They traced the signature to what we believe to be an ancient observatory at the heart of the city, but they've had little time to probe it, unfortunately. Not one day after entering the city, they've come under attack. They reported shadowy figures in the distance, and curious projectile weapons launched from an ever-encroaching mist. So far, they've managed to hold the line, but a number of them have been killed, and the higher-ups are demanding that we withdraw in full within the next 48 hours. It is, to say the least, a regrettable state of affairs. But I like to see the opportunity in everything. We still have 48 hours to make what we can of the city and the technology left behind. I believe someone of your expertise may be well suited to the task. Find out what you can, and if anything can be recovered, see to it that it arrives here in one piece. Above all else, I want to know if the ancients figured out how to travel as we do. If you bring me proof of that, well, you will be handsomely rewarded. Now then, please step onto the platform and we will get you on your way. Do remember, you only have 48 hours, and should go without saying that if anything should happen to you while you're down there, well, we don't know anything about it. I hope you understand. You kneel down on cold stone, your head bowed low, and your body aching as if your skin was about to burst and splatter your muscles all over the ground. Your head throbs, and you hear a loud buzzing in your ears. In this sorry state, it's not long before you heave up last night's dinner and collapse onto your back. You look up at the metallic sky, thick with dark clouds, allowing barely any light to pass through. It's not raining, but it's threatening to at any moment. You almost wish it would. You could use a nice splash to the face right about now. Instead, you have to settle for the light breeze and the cool stones beneath you. "Take your time," someone calls out to you. "I heard it's worse here because of some quantum mumbo-jumbo." You tilt your head back and find a well-built man in black military garb standing over you. His skin is pale in stark contrast to his jet-black hair and deep brown eyes. With all the armor he's wearing, you mistake him for a knight at first. At least, until you see the Radeon MK5 pulse rifle cradled in his arms. "Pleased to make your acquaintance? I'm Captain Seamus Devereaux." Seamus offers you a hand, and the moment you take it, he launches you up onto your feet, catching you by the collar of your shirt. You struggle to find your footing, but his firm grip keeps you vertical. Eventually, you stabilize, and taking a deep breath, you give yourself a once-over and see that you're dressed in the same military kit as Seamus. Glancing around, you realize that you're in the middle of an open camp, with cases laying around and a makeshift armory set up just a few feet away. You also spot a hard case by your feet, which you remember taking with you before you traveled down here. Seamus picks up the case and hands it to you.
Before you open that, you'd best tell me what 2+2 is. If your brain is fried, you have no business using what's inside there.
You press a palm against your forehead,
and taking another deep breath, you finally manage to shake most of your discomfort. Alright, 2 plus 2 then. 4, you say. Last I checked, it's 4. Oh, good. Well, open her up then. You're going to be needing that. You lift the case up and pop it open, revealing a Radeon 223 pistol, a couple of magazines, and a laser sight. Can't say it's my favorite kit, but it's reliable at least. Seamus holds the case open for you while you prep the pistol and stash your spare magazines in a pouch strapped to your leg. So, you're in charge here? I am. Seamus sets the case aside and gestures for you to follow him. He takes you for a quick spin around the camp, which is contained within an area enclosed by tarps. You find it mostly acting as a cache of weapons, but there is also an emergency beacon and a small station set up to monitor quantum fields, as well as the level of electromagnetic interference. You can see a fairly strong disturbance registering on the screen. There's something here that wasn't in the other cities we explored. Everyone who came through here lurched just like you did. One poor bastard dropped down outside the walls, and we had to rush to scoop him up. Outside the walls? Hang tight. We'll get there. But before that, I have a couple of ground rules we need to go over. Seamus holds up a hand with one extended finger. Rule 1. You do not go outside the walls. Rule 2. My word is law inside and outside of these walls. And number 3, we're leaving in exactly 47 hours and 45 minutes. If you are not with us when we leave, you're stuck. Am I understood? You nod. Good. Now then, I'm sure you're tired of gawking at all this. Let's see what you came here for. Seamus leads you over to the edge of the camp, and, drawing back the tarp, he lets you step out into the city. Even at a first glance, you realize this is not some hilltop ring of rocks arranged by a Neolithic man. No. This was the abode of higher beings, standing in utter defiance to anything one might presume of a culture preceding the first pyramids by centuries. Athlone, or whatever the ancient inhabitants called this place, is both megalithic and modern. The first thing you notice are the high walls, composed of titanic blocks of stone, pressed together without mortar. You rush over and run your hand over where two of the blocks meet, and find that it would be impossible to pass even the thinnest sheet of paper between them. What's more startling is that each massive stone, at least from what you can see, is perfectly curved and smooth, so as to follow the natural arc of the circular walls. You wonder where the builders of this place could have quarried such massive blocks of limestone, and how on earth they conveyed them here, and what artisans could bend the stone to their will as if it were mere clay. You wonder if perhaps the readings were wrong, and you're actually a few millennia ahead. Though, even for a civilization of 1000 BCE, you'd be astounded at the craftsmanship and force of engineering on display here. You can find a number of ramps within the walls leading to the wall walk, and presumably, the battlements. But before you rush up, you look the other way, greeted by a magnificent arcade in the round, with simple arches trimmed with gold plating, embossed with swirling designs and other geometric curiosities. Through the arcade, you can see a number of domed and conical structures, glass windows, all trimmed with gold. Your mind recalls the simple huts you'd expect of Neolithic Europe, but the radiance of the stone, even in the dim light, makes them look far too opulent to belong to any who might till the fields in this antique and remote era. Your feet carry you toward the arcade, but Seamus grabs hold of you and leads you over to the nearest ramp and up onto the wall walk. You ascend and find yourself atop the ring wall, which rises some 20 feet off the ground, watching over the surrounding environs, most of which is just the rolling fields of grass and what would come to be known as the River Shannon. There are a number of individuals here, all outfitted with the same military kit as you and Seamus. And they all patrol about, pulse rifles held at the ready, and their eyes fixed on something in the distance. Curiously, you find a thick, nigh impenetrable fog just on the other side of the river. Looking down, you see the walls studded with a highly reflective metallic surface, as if to present an uneven mirror to any who might approach the city. The battlements are likewise adorned, and they too are part of the single blocks of masonry that join to form the wall. But if anything truly captures your attention, it's the ornate cannons which appear at regular intervals between the battlements. The shape is unmistakable, but they are a tangle of valves, pipes, and other decorative elements, as if to dazzle more than to terrify.
Oh, trust me, I've tried to make them work, Seamus says. We couldn't even find what they fired. And it's a shame, I'll tell ya, because whatever they were, they clearly did their job. Sissy's almost completely untouched inside.
Then, where is everyone? Why go through all this trouble to fortify if you were just gonna pack up and leave?
Well, that's one thing you might find out. Our employers seem to think that they skipped town the same way that you and I got here. Honestly, doesn't matter anyway. We don't need to know why. We just need to know how.
You don't enjoy a good mystery, then?
I don't have time to play Sherlock. Quite frankly, neither do you.
Before you can speak another word, Seamus points out over the city walls. You follow the line of his finger to a spot just across the river and at the edge of the fog. You don't see anything at first, but as you strain to get a better look, you notice dark patches drifting just behind the curtain of mist. At first, there's just one or two, but soon, you see an alarming number of them massing there. Seamus gestures for you to kneel down, and you do, peering out from between the battlements to see what's going on. Seamus whistles, and on cue, he and his fellow soldiers level their pulse rifles at the shadowy forms. They all hold fast, waiting for their mysterious foes to make a move. And so they do. Three or four of the shadowy figures emerge from the mist, carrying what look like crossbows. And quite quickly, they take aim. You see the assailants dressed in long, dark, flowing robes, with their faces obscured by large hoods. All you can really make out is the intricate designs which run all over the robes, glistening now, even in the muted light. A long beat passes as both sides size each other up, until finally, one of the enemy number fires a projectile, missing their shot, causing it to slam into the wall and then ricochet off like a bullet, casting a cyan glow as it fires upward, pierces through the clouds. You have little time to mull over what the projectile was, as Seamus and his crew flick off their safeties and begin firing their pulse rifles, unloading blue-hot rounds into the enemy, until they're mowed down. More of the shadowy figures rush out from the mist and drag back the fallen into the relative safety of their opaque curtain, ending the skirmish no sooner than it began. It takes you a moment, but you notice that there was no blood shed. And in thinking back to the moment that just transpired, you realize that just as many emerged to rescue the fallen had adventured out, and that the whole operation was conducted quickly and in utter silence. If you had to hazard a guess, you'd probably think that they were just testing your defenses. At least for the moment, it would appear that Seamus and his crew are in fact up to the task. Ugh, not so tough when they can't catch us by surprise. Seamus pops off a few more rounds into the mist for good measure, and then signals for everyone else to hold fire and continue standing guard. He heaves you to your feet and looks you right in the eye. They were a little more timid than usual, but I promise you, when they sense weakness, they're like a school of piranhas. So, you find what we're looking for, and you let me know right away. Because the second we begin to evacuate, I'm certain they're going to fall on us, and I want to make sure I'm damn well ready when that time comes. Captain, I understand completely. Just tell me where I need to go, and I'll get right to work. Good. Center of the city. You can walk right through the inner rings, and that'll take you to the big dome smack dab in the middle. We've made what provisions we can for you, so if you don't take too much time, see what you can find, and then report back to me in, oh, let's say 2 or 3 hours. Seamus waves you off and returns to the business of watching for the shadowy enemy. You linger for a moment, trying to spot something in the fog, but you find the grisaille curtain offers little beyond your own imagination. And so you descend by the ramp and pass under the arcade, taking your first steps into the city proper. The ancient and the advanced intersect so perfectly here in the streets of this dead city. It's as if the inhabitants leapt straight from the Stone Age and into the modern era, bringing their humble assumptions and habits with them. While you haven't been able to lavish much time upon exploring the residences of the vanished populace, you spared enough to see that these are really little more than huts, given a luxury makeover in stone. Every residence is conical and massive. As with the city, the homes are laid out in rings, with an inner ring girding a central fire pit. But instead of burnt logs, you spied what you might only describe as a gas stove, with a central grill mounted over an exhaust. And further out, there is a ring of seats, cut in a quartz-like stone and adorned with animal furs and cushions decorated with spiraling, almost hypnotic, designs. And finally, an outer ring set into the wall carves out sufficient space for beds, likewise adorned with furs and cushions. Everything in these homes faces inwards to the central fire, and with all the inhabitants plain view of the others. If you removed the fine masonry and replaced it with tree branches, thatch, and dirt, you'd have a perfect diorama of a Neolithic hut. Whoever these people were, they clearly valued where they came from. As with their homes, the city is arranged for all to live in the circle, protecting each other, keeping watch, and keeping their focus turned inward. And so it is that you keep on towards the heart of the city, deviating from your path only slightly to peer into any home with the doors left ajar. You pass through 2 residential rings, encountering nary a soul, before you come to what you presume to be the center of this ancient settlement, girded round by a moat and thick walls, allowing only the bulge of the central structure to jut out into view. find a bridge before you, which takes you over the water and up to the walls. But you find it odd that there is no gate or portal to greet you. Instead, you have to walk the circumference of the walls until you find a portal at the eastern side of the structure. You spot another bridge, granting passage over the water, but find it poorly aligned with the eastern entrance. You doubt the builders of this place, miraculous in their work as they were, would make such a simple mistake. But then, you recall that it can be folly to ascribe too much credit and brilliance to any ancient civilization, because, as you so often have to remind yourself, they too were human, and thus were prone to err. Carrying on, you enter the central structure, passing under the arched door and finding yourself in a vaulted corridor. The length of the corridor is considerable, with whatever lays at its end appearing indistinguishable at this great distance. But at least the corridor is not barren. No, its ceilings and walls are in fact lavishly decorated with swirling geometric designs and floral details not unlike those you've spotted throughout the entirety of the city. All done in gold, the designs convey the idea of a maelstrom, perhaps. Or if you were to be even more adventurous, the great spiraling arms of a galaxy. As you trace the lines of the designs, you come to find great circular discs fixed into the ceiling, rendering scenes of pastoral and nomadic life. The first such scene you come across is rendered in shallow relief, in gold, no less, depicting a group of hunter-gatherers in stark realism as they lay in wait, spears in hand, while a stag mounts a nearby hill. Continuing on, you find the same figures now standing over a field of wheat, scythes raised in the act of reaping their harvest. And in the distance of the second scene, you can make out the small huts huddled together to form the beginnings of a village. Further down, about halfway along the corridor, you find another scene depicting the newly minted farmers greeting strangers from the sea. The strangers, in stark contrast to the farmers, are dressed in flowing robes and are adorned with crowns of mistletoe, bog rosemary, and eastern lilies. The strangers all wear their hair long and wild on their heads, with the men sporting beards that would make Harald Hardrada jealous. Both parties come together and greet each other with much merriment, exchanging gifts of produce, meat, and jewelry, among other things. Intrigued, you pick up the pace, looking for the next panel in this ancient Sistine Chapel. You jog ahead and plant your feet once you've reached the next image in the sequence. Here, you see the visitors and the original inhabitants living together, with the former raising vast structures through apparently magical means, directing great beams of light which draw the familiar ringed cities from the earth. All present revel and take great pride in the work being done, looking at the multitude of cities which now dot the land, with a great number of both peoples marching in the distance to take up residence in their newly forged homes. But as you scan the scene for every detail, you see at the far edge a storm brewing and strange ships making landfall at the extreme edge of the relief. You jog ahead, anxious to view the next scene. But you instead arrive at the end of the corridor, stepping into the grand chamber at the heart of the structure. You're already looking up when you step inside, and you're glad you are. Up above,
Spread out across the interior of the massive dome is a scene of cosmic brilliance, with dazzling lights twinkling in a sea of darkness. You recognize the great channel of the Milky Way arcing across the dome like the tail of some impossibly vast comet. As you step further into the room and cast your eyes about the celestial scene, you come to realize that the twinkling of the heavenly lights depicted here is not the result of painterly sleight of hand, but rather is the result of a photographic reproduction taken now in this very moment. You look to where the dome meets the walls, and as you focus on the minute lights at the very fringes, you think you see them drifting beyond view. And then, the scene whips away, smearing the lights across the dome until the view is fixed on another arm of the galaxy.
In case you are wondering, yes, it is a live feed.
A deep voice calls out. Your head is spinning from the galactic dance you just witnessed, but after taking a moment to orient yourself, you cast your eyes about and find your man standing there at a podium near the center of the room. He's a dark, thin fellow with a shaved head and a long, curly beard. He looks too small for his military gear, but he exudes a certain confidence about him, mostly from the two fox-like eyes which leer at you from behind a pair of wire-framed glasses.
You must be the backup.
You approach the man and offer your hand to him. He reaches out, but as he takes his hand away from the podium, he leaves a small sphere attached to it spinning, which sends the view above into a spiraling light show again. You look away, not keen on losing your lunch twice in one day, and take his hand.
I am Abu Bakr. Seamus left me in charge of this place until the help arrived.
You shake hands and then blow past him, your eyes fixed on the podium and the sphere mounted to it.
Nice to meet you too.
Abu Bakr seizes the sphere, stopping the light show above. Now that you can get a better look at it, you find it to be covered in the same spiraling designs you've seen everywhere, lacking any apparent means of measurement. What you'd hoped to be some kind of astrolabe instead appears to be little more than a glorified joystick.
A fantastic piece of technology, isn't it? I still can't figure out how it is we're seeing what we're seeing, despite the weather of all things. You can't even see the stars at night outside now, but the view in here is clearer than anything I've even seen back home.
This is amazing, I'll give you that. Whoever they were, the people that built this place were clearly some very accomplished astronomers.
I don't think we would be down here if that is all they were. I've been to worlds where the pharaohs fly around in steam-powered chariots, and that you could call just another day at work.
I take it the signal the higher-ups were interested in is strongest right here? Abu Bakr leads you over to a terminal like the one set up at Seamus' camp. You read the monitors and find the corresponding signal. Can I see it compared to the one at the campsite? Abu Bakr opens up a panel and selects base camp from the menu, dragging the graph over until it's overlaid on the current signal. You see that whatever the machines are picking up, it's at least 3 times as powerful here.
If this is what we think it is, then this is the room where their journey began.
Abu Bakr paces about the room, leading you along the walls, which bear identical scenes to those depicted on the roof of the corridor, likewise in large circular discs of gold, this time framed with spiraling floral masses. And beyond those, the white walls and the celestial display above, there's almost nothing indicating that this was anything resembling a launch pad. The only outlier, besides the podium, is a small reflecting pool in the center of the room, with a statue of a three-faced god standing in the center. At most, it's a decorative flair, and you pay it no mind.
So, what do you think?
What do I think? I think I need more than 5 minutes.
Indeed. I've been here a little while now, and I still can't make heads or tails of it. The artwork, the architecture, and this. They are all magnificent feats for any civilization. But I can't work out how they made the leap to... well, you know.
We still don't know if they did. If I had to hazard a guess, then maybe the podium and the sphere are used to locate where you want to go. But what I can't put my finger on is how you'd indicate when. I'm looking around. Is when even an option? Abu Bakr crosses his arms and looks up at the dome, his brow furrowed in deep thought. You stand beside him, searching the stars for something you may have missed. But nothing disturbs the smooth surface projecting the image. There is no masonry or device jutting out from the smooth surface, and again, no markings to denote measurement or alignment of any kind. Nothing which will readily give up the secrets of the vanished folk who once gazed upon the heavenly dance.
You know, Shay must put me on this detail here because I was the only egghead left alive after our last skirmish with the enemy out there.
Abu Bakr chuckles.
But I'm not even a scientist.
Well, what do you do then?
I am a student of history. I can work the tech well enough, but my job is to brief the teams I work with on who they may encounter whenever they arrive somewhere.
Well, I have to admit, I'm a little puzzled myself. I think our bosses overestimated my knowledge of Ireland. I tried to tell them when they came, but they weren't very keen on listening.
Let me guess. Your expertise is on Rome and Greece.
You smile, unable to look over at Abu Bakr. You hadn't wanted to say anything because there was no saying no to anyone back at home. And once you got here, the mystery of everything was just too enthralling. You had to know more, at least with the little time you had.
Well, I suppose we have a little time for a history lesson. Honestly, the word sounds strange in my mouth, but myth would be vulgar after everything I've seen.
How do you mean?
Have you ever heard of a people known as the Tuatha De Danann?
The words sound alien to you, and you're almost certain your face is contorting into a mask of utter confusion. You turn to look at Abu Bakr straight on, hanging on whatever his next word will be. But your lesson is cut short.
You two, cut the chit-chat and come with me, right now.
You spot Seamus at the entrance of the vault, his pulse rifle in hand. He waves for you to come, and seeing that both you and Abu Bakr remain glued in place, he screams,
No!
You rush over, following on Seamus's heels as you haul ass down the corridor and back out into the city. You run through the streets, making for the wall where every available soldier is either gearing up or rushing up the ramps, armed to the teeth and ready for a fight. Sensing that your pistol won't be enough, you snatch up a pulse rifle from the armory. Then you and Abu Bakr follow Seamus up the ramp, joining him at the battlements, where he wastes no time extending a bipod from the barrel of his rifle and setting up. He motions for both of you to do likewise. You fumble with your weapon, and as you do, you look down the barrel and further downfield until your eyes reach the wall of mist across the river. Used by dozens, perhaps a few hundred shadowy forms massing at the edge of the fog. Some half emerging from it, weapons at the ready. Your heart races, and you fumble with your own bipod, trying desperately to get your gun leveled and ready. Your efforts are so frantic that you almost forget to switch the safety off.
I hope you two don't mind, but we have a slightly more pressing matter on our hands.
And with that, Seamus flips off the safety on his rifle, and peering through a small scope, takes in the enemy numbers.
Now, on my command.
Seamus takes a deep breath, and you do likewise. You take aim, planting your feet firmly beneath you, and bracing the stock against your body. All set, you watch as the massing darkness at the edge of the mist grows deeper and deeper, the line of it expanding further in either direction. And then finally, a robed enemy enters center stage from behind their misty veil and raise their weapons with clear intent. You rest your finger against the trigger, awaiting Seamus' order. And after a long beat, he finally gives it. Fire!
That was Rings in the Mist, Part 1, by Kevin Valbenesi. If you don't want to wait to hear the next 4 installments, you can find all of them in our Patreon page and just binge listen to them. Kevin also has some other new stories in our Patreon page, which you probably haven't heard because they haven't been made public yet. There's a story, for instance, about a Muslim conquest of southern Europe. And there's another that takes place in medieval Japan, and there's this eerie glowing orb that kills samurai. If you agree Kevin is a master storyteller, like I do, why not support him by joining us on Patreon, and he will continue to produce his amazing stories for you. And as a bonus, you will get Twilight History's merch. A mug, a shirt, a hoodie, or stickers, all for you. To get this swag, all you have to do is sign up to our Patreon page and stick around for 3 months in the same tier. So why not go ahead and do that? You can find our link to Patreon by visiting the website at twilighthistories.com. And now, for an update on our role-playing game. I had some great feedback from one of our listeners, Ryan Lazarus, who recommended I build out the framework of different campaigns. And that's exactly what I'm doing for our Game Masters. I'm just wrapping up one of our first right now. It's called The Seas of Poseidon. The premise is that the Turks were going to conquer Constantinople. It was inevitable, and the Emperor knew it. And there was no escape. He couldn't fight his way out. He would just have to stay there and have a last stand. But a scholar found a fascinating little jewel of a rumor that a Nordic people discovered a continent. And it was empty. Well, pretty much. The Romans had got up and moved before. They escaped from Rome to Constantinople. And apparently, in the mythical past, Aeneas had escaped Troy to found Rome. Wasn't Rome more of an idea than a place? So why not move that idea across an ocean where it could be safe? Anyways, that's the world for the first game I'm building out right now. And if you're a game master, feel free to go to the website and check it out. There is no cost. This is just something I really want to exist in the universe, so I'm building it out for you. The website is twilighthistories.com. And that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Until next time, take care.